Welcome to Speaking Out.
We're mainly discussing land rights and economic empowerment.
Aboriginal enterprises in mining, exploration and energy.
I'd like to talk a little bit about Indigenous constitutional recognition.
With Larissa Berendt.
It's a fresh view coming up.
On ABC Radio.
The common sort of belief is that Aboriginal men were treated as equals during the war and that they weren't treated very well after the war. And sort of that's in general, you could say that. But Aboriginal men, when they came into the AIF, they came in on the back foot. First of all, because they're Aboriginal, and society was very prejudiced against Aboriginal people.
Black Diggers, the Indigenous response to World War One. This is Speaking Out, I'm Jay McAllister. Each year, Anzac Day serves as an opportunity for Indigenous communities to reflect on the wartime contributions of First Nations men and women. Indigenous Australians have a long history of wartime action. From the frontier massacres of colonial Australia to the story of Anzac and all other conflicts which followed. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander involvement in the First World War occurred despite a policy restricting a large number of them from enlisting. So how many Indigenous Australians managed to serve? What and who were they fighting for? And how does this involvement impact the need for recognition of Indigenous rights in contemporary Australia? These are just some of the questions we aim to answer on Speaking Out.
My name is Pastor Ray Minicon. I'm from the Cubby Cubby people on my father's side, or Gubby Gubby, and Goring Goring on my mother's side. They need to be recognised, and we just got to bring it out into the open and say, well, our people did fight for this country, and it goes back right back into history, including the Boer War and every other war after that, and our people put up their hands and says, yeah, I'll come out and join in too. And for a variety of reasons, but they came back without recognition. Many of them didn't get their soldiers' benefits and all those kinds of things. Like my grandfather, for example, who fought in the Light Horse, buried up in Gympie in an unmarked grave. And I just think that's an injustice.
I'm Philippa Scarlett. I've been interested in World War One Aboriginal service for over 2 decades now. And I'm the author of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Volunteers for the AIF, the Indigenous Response to World War One. I think what tells us why the stories have remained silent for so long has been the attitude of the white community. First of all, Australia was fighting to keep Australia white in World War One, and there was such terrible racism and prejudice in Australian society. I don't think Aboriginal men were particularly valued and their service wasn't valued. Aboriginal families, of course, knew about what their own relatives had contributed, and they would have liked recognition, very much liked recognition, and were bitter that they didn't receive it. That's what I feel about the lack of recognition. It was a white problem, not an Aboriginal problem.
Let's break it down. How many people of an Indigenous background enlisted in the war? I put this question to Indigenous liaison at the Australian War Memorial, Michael Bell.
At the moment, we've got just a little over 1,200 men that enlisted or tried to enlist, but the lesser number of 857 actually saw active service overseas. Of that, about 25% rejection rate, we find that 90% of those men were rejected because of race, and that has to do with the restrictions that were put in from the 1903 Defence Act, amended in 1909, which was specifically prohibited people of non-substantive European heritage or origin enlisting in the first AIF.
So what was it like for Aboriginal people who wanted to join the military? And given the treatment of their ancestors, what and who were they fighting for?
The enlistment process was the same for everybody. However, because of the nature of the individual enlisters, Aboriginality wasn't automatically precluded. The medical officers at the different, the next stages were the judges, and some of those said, yes, you could go in, and some didn't. Obviously, what we're looking at here is the view of individual medical officers determining the Aboriginality or the dark of your skin, the colour of your skin, the tone of your skin. Some of the refusals stayed on there. They were refused because they were Aboriginal. It's as simple as that. Others got in that were clearly of darker complexion and facial features, got in without a problem on their first go.
Aboriginal men really didn't leave to a large extent, major extent. They didn't state why they enlisted, but people have speculated, me included, that recruitment campaigns were pretty aggressive. Mates were joining, brothers were joining. Also, Aboriginal men, they did want to fight for their country, I think, and they were, perhaps they wanted to fight for their country in the Aboriginal sense, their country. There are those things that probably motivated them. Then there was pay and there was travel. Some people have said Aboriginal men were fighting for the rights which they didn't have. And that could well be true, but there's not really documentation during the war that was the case. But after the war, there are references to this, particularly Aboriginal communities mentioned it because they were disappointed that their men had fought and didn't get rights, and then there were penalties which were suffered in communities. But one Aboriginal man called me from Cherbourg that his father, who was in World War One, said that he had gone to the war because he didn't want his country to be invaded yet again. And there's another interesting factor about Aboriginal war service, that it was linked to loyalty to the Crown, which is surprising when you think that the Crown was the agency behind Aboriginal dispossession.
For those Aboriginal men who did manage to serve, did they face the same discrimination many of their family and friends experienced back home? Here's Philippa Scarlett.
Well, yes, this is quite an interesting question, because the common sort of belief is that Aboriginal men were treated as equals during the war and that they weren't treated very well after the war. And sort of that's in general, you could say that. But Aboriginal men, when they came into the AIF, they came in on the back foot. First of all, because they're Aboriginal, and society was very prejudiced against Aboriginal people. And although another common wisdom is we were all mates, I found that when Aboriginal men came into the war, they had to prove themselves. They had to prove themselves in two ways, which white people didn't have to do. They had to prove themselves as individuals, but also in terms of Aboriginal men as soldiers in combat, one example is of Aboriginal men having to prove themselves was that a light horse officer said, "We didn't think they were very dependable before we saw them fight, and we were very worried that they wouldn't be able to make the grade. But after we saw them fight, we changed our mind." So Aboriginal men during the war didn't have an easy time. There wasn't the equality which is sometimes emphasised. And also, even when Aboriginal men are praised, Aboriginal soldiers by other soldiers, and they're thought of very highly, there's always that qualification, and this appears quite constantly. Although he was Aboriginal, he was a good man or was a brave fellow, despite the fact that he was Aboriginal. But he was Aboriginal, but he was brave. So these qualifications say a lot about the mindset, which translated from the general mindset in the Australian community, which just didn't suddenly disappear when the war started and Aboriginal men joined the AIF.
Most assume recognition of Indigenous Australians in our military has been a fairly recent undertaking. But it turns out there have been several historical attempts to identify the extent of this involvement.
The first efforts were made to recognise Aboriginal men were made in the 1931 and 1932, when the RSL, it was then called the Returned Soldiers and Sailors, Imperial League of Australia, I think something like that. Anyhow, they decided to publish in their journal, Ravalli, lists of Aboriginal men who'd served in Victoria and Queensland and New South Wales. And to do that, that was a pretty informal process. They approached police stations and managers of missions and also used word of mouth. And that was really the first recognition of Aboriginal servicemen. But I wouldn't place too much store by it in terms of the community as a whole, because it was a very limited publication of Aboriginal service, because it was only for a was for a veteran audience, basically. It wasn't for a world, for an Australia-wide audience, veterans and their families. But that was really the first step, and they actually managed to identify 245 men. This was far below the numbers which actually exist, but it wasn't too bad. But nothing really happened. Aboriginal Service just sort of sank after these Ravalli articles, and I don't think much notice was taken of them. But in the early 1970s, Chris Clark, who was a military historian, he happened to come across the articles and he realised their significance. And he wrote a couple of articles himself based on Aboriginal War Service for the military history journal Sabretash. And then following that, I would identify a number of milestones, and they were things like Don Cameron, an MP from Queensland. He produced a list of Aboriginal servicemen. And then there was David Huggenson, who did a wonderful exhibition, Too Dark for the Light Horse. Rod Pratt did a number of articles on Queensland Aboriginal men. And from the Aboriginal perspective, Doreen Catenary wrote Narangeri Anzacs. Alec Jacquemos and Dennis Fowle, they wrote a fantastic book called Forgotten Anzacs. That was mainly what was happening in the up to the turn of the century. And then things moved on a bit. There was the National Archives Bringing Them Home project, which produced a list of Indigenous servicemen. And actually, they publicised this list. And this list raised the number of men from 245 to up to over 600. There were very public events like Black Diggers, the play by Wesley Enoch and Tom Wright. And before that, there was Ray Minikin's Coloured Digger March in Redfern, which is still ongoing. That started in 2007.
Well, as all good stories start, it started in a pub. And as you know, in a pub, we solve all the world's problems and then we walk out the door. Well, this one here, we sort of walked out the door and said we'd do something about it. And I was talking to a friend of mine. He's a non-Indigenous person. He said, "Ray, we've got to do something about this." And so we conducted our first little Anzac Day ceremony just to give recognition to our own Aboriginal diggers at a little place called Crossroads there in Redfern when I was the minister there. And out of that, we decided to have a march just to, down the streets of Redfern there on Anzac Day. After the big march had finished, we would come out when everyone's playing two up and having a beer. We said, okay, we'd honour our diggers on that particular day because that's the day when these things are recognised. We just wanted to invite our own community, but it just turned into this bigger program that's now with the Coloured Diggers March here in Redfern, which is, I guess, beyond my imagination. It's grown into something that is bigger and greater than all of us and deserves the kind of respect and recognition and the honour due to the people who have served in all of these wars.
Organisers said they held a separate service because too often Indigenous diggers were ignored.
When you're in the trenches, the bullets aren't worried about the Duco. You're gone. You are gone.
It was based upon a poem by Bert Berros, who is a Canadian, actually, who fought with and saw the exploits of an Aboriginal soldier in the Papua New Guinea conflict, and his name was Private Harold West.
He came and joined the colours when the war god's anvil rang. He took up modern weapons to replace his boomerang. He waited for no call-up. He didn't need a push. He came in from the stations and the townships of the bush. He helped when help was wanting, just because he wasn't deaf. He is right amongst the columns of the fighting AIF. He's always there when wanted, when his Owen gun or Bren. He's in the forward area, the place where men are men. He proved he's still a warrior, in action, not afraid. He faced a blasting red-hot fire from mortar and grenade. He didn't mind when food was low, or we were getting thin. He didn't growl or worry then, he'd cheer us with his grin. He'd heard us talk democracy, that preach it to his face, yet knows that in our federal house there's no one of his race. He feels we push his kinsmen out where cities do not reach, and Parliament has yet to hear the Abbo's maiden speech. One day he'll leave the army, then join the league he shall, and he hopes we'll give a better deal to the Aboriginal.
As the story, the Colour Digger story, emerged in our community, the story was not just only about Harold West. It was about all of us, and I think our Uncle Harold's spirit is now fighting for all that kind of recognition and honour and respect for all Indigenous soldiers. And there's so many more stories to be told. I can tell you stories that are, you know, where an Aboriginal digger from Bourke, for example, he got a DCM, but who would know? He fought alongside his brother over there. It's only in recent years that his story has been told, and his grave now has been properly recognised, and he's been recognised. But how many more stories are like that?
So Yamagara Nindali, Des Crump Naya, Murragawea Dirranbandi. So hello to everyone. My name is Des Crump. I'm an Aboriginal man from Dirranbandi. So my family links are Gamilaroi Nation, and I'm the Indigenous Languages Coordinator at the State Library of Queensland. Yeah, well, all up, we found out there's about 290 men who enlisted from Queensland or had a footprint in Queensland, as we like to say. There's a few from the northern rivers of New South Wales that enlisted, say, at Mullumbimby or Moolumbar, Lismore, Coyogle. They did their training up here in Brisbane and joined from up here. There's quite a number from the missions, particularly Cherbourg, several from Taroom, and also Yarrabah up in North Queensland. And then we've also, there's quite a few from Toomla or the old Yarrabah Mission along the Queensland-New South Wales border, which is where my family is from. A large number of those men were hoping to enlist to, I guess, get away from that mission life and the restrictions of the Protection Act. Some of them saw it as a way to perhaps even get an exemption from the Protection Act. And there's a great story of the boys from Baramba, which the Ration Shed uncovered in their ANZAC 100 project, and we supported their research through the State Library. There were 16 Aboriginal blokes who enlisted from Cherbourg and or Baramba, as it was back then. They came down to Brisbane with the mission superintendent, and when they had the recruiting march down George Street, they heard the cry of who's going to fill the empty saddles, and these young blokes all jumped up on the horses and rode down the main street as proud as punch. And one of them, he didn't quite have enough paperwork because under the Defence Act, you needed to have substantially European origin or descent. And this bloke didn't have enough paperwork. So he was put on the train back to Cherbourg or back to Mergen, and then picked up at Mergen and at the train station and taken back home. The other blokes, they stayed at the depot at the training camp for a month. And unfortunately, the sad part was they've enlisted, they've shown that bravery and loyalty, and all of them were sent back. The army decided that they were essentially too Aboriginal, too black to join the service. There's a set of letters from one of the Blackman brothers up here who was separated from his family at Cherbourg and was trying to reconnect with them, and he wrote this scathing letter to the Queensland government, where he was saying, well, when he went and fought for king and country, he thought things might get better. He thought that his life would change, but he said coming back, he's just been treated like a mongrel dog. And fortunately, there are some good stories. My great-uncle, for example, and two other blokes from the Yarrabah Mission on the Queensland-New South border, just near Boomai, they had a welcome home. One of the very few examples of a welcome home that's been documented or reported, and the Defence Department sent up representatives from Sydney, and it was written up in several newspapers at the time back in 1919. And it was also one of the first memorials that highlighted Aboriginal soldiers. There was the three of them, Jack Stacey, George Bennett and Charles Turner Bird, that were on the original war memorial there at Yeraba, and then when Yeraba closed down shortly after, they moved to where present-day Toomula is now near Bogabilla, and the memorial was moved over there, and then it was added later on with the soldiers from the Second World War and then later Vietnam and other conflicts.
Another history which has largely gone untold is that of Tasmanian Aboriginal involvement in the war.
My name is Andrea Gerard, and I have masters from the University of Tasmania. I'm a historian with an interest in social history and military history. People kept saying to me, oh, I didn't know there were any Aboriginals who served. When I did my project, I had 74, and I think that there's probably, I've been given the names of about probably another three or four from Kangaroo Island who were the descendants of Tasmanian Aboriginal women. Probably one of the trends I observed was the fact that these men, the chances of them being promoted past the point of being a non-commissioned officer was very slim. We have one guy who was made a lieutenant. He was probably one of the first or the second officer, Aboriginal officer, to be commissioned. Also, they probably hadn't been exposed to things like respiratory conditions and things like that, so they soon became ill. Basically, it's the fact that the opportunities for promotion were slim, because who wants to be told what to do by an Aboriginal man? If people knew that they were Aboriginal, they would be looked down on considerably.
And why do you think it is that people would have that assumption that no or not many Aboriginal men from Tasmania would have served?
I think it's most of us simply ignorance and not having thought that these people. See, there's 18 people from Cape Barron Island. If you look at the population there, that is a lot. Nearly all the young men have gone gone away. And my suspicion is that the teacher who was on the schoolmaster who was on the island there had a background in the British Army, and he thought that he wanted to encourage and definitely encourage these men to enlist.
All out to guard. Most unusual guard this in all the Empire's army. We meet the only all Aboriginal squad in the AIF, Original Aboriginal Anzac. They're not in the army as a curiosity. They are volunteers in the service of the country they love. They come from Australia's oldest family. They've got a fighting tradition thousands of years old. In the battle dress of the soldier of 1941, hunting through the Australian bush, where once, like black shadows, their ancestors stalked the foe. Here, surely, is one of the strangest sidelights of the greatest war the world has known. With fixed bayonets instead of the spears their forefathers carried, with bullets instead of boomerangs, the dark-hued diggers go into action.
I like the story of Alfred Herbst, I suppose, because he's the one that becomes an officer. Alfred is actually the descendant of Dolly Dalrymple, a well-known lady from the northwest coast. He's reasonably well educated. He lives around at Queenstown at the outbreak of the war. He's working as a clerk there, and he's also involved with the local militia there. So he's got, when he enlists in August 1914, he's already got some experience. So he's soon promoted to on the formation of the 12th Battalion. He's soon promoted to the rank of sergeant. So he enlists very early in the piece. So he's there when the 12th Battalion is formed at Pontville Army Camp, and goes away with the 12th Battalion on Gallipoli. He, one stage, I think he probably has something like a nervous breakdown or whatever, and is sent away. But otherwise, he seems to have managed to, with the losses that the 12th Battalion had, he is then promoted to the rank of lieutenant, so he's a second lieutenant. So he serves at Mokay Farm, and at Mokay Farm, unfortunately, he is killed in action.
Alfred James Ryan, age 22 years, 6 months, height 5 feet, 11 inches, weight 174 pounds, complexion dark, eyes brown, hair brown. Religion, Roman Catholic.
Well, Alfred Ryan, he was one of a group of Aboriginal soldiers. It's a very small group, as far as we know, who actually wrote letters home. And these are extraordinarily valuable. And he was a shearer. He came from the Peakill district of New South Wales, and he was Wiradjuri. Like some other Aboriginal people might have lived in town, or they were sort of separated from their communities in some way, but he grew up in an Aboriginal community. He volunteered in 1915. He served with the 3rd Battalion and 2nd Battalion, and later with the Machine Gun Company. And he was one of the 75 Aboriginal men we know to have served at Gallipoli. He served on Gallipoli and was wounded. And by 1916, he was in France. And on the 25th of September, he was killed near the Ypres Menin Road. And when his remains were identified, because he wasn't found immediately, one way of identifying him was the fact that they found his AFR ANZAC badge, which was given to men who'd served at Gallipoli. His letters home, I think, are pretty interesting. But first of all, I should mention why the letters actually existed, because he wasn't only a soldier, he was actually a New South Wales heavyweight boxer. He wrote letters home back to his friends in the boxing world, and then these letters found their way into the press. Now, for me, I'll just make 3 points about the letters, which I find very notable. First of all, his description of what happened in the trench he was in Gallipoli. And second was his generosity, because he not only talking about Australians, he also talks about the Greeks and talks about Indians and New Zealanders.
The landing took place within half a mile of where thousands of Greeks were simply massacred trying to force a landing, which they never succeeded in doing some time back. We are strongly entrenched on the peninsula now, inland about 2 miles, with the New Zealanders on our left flank. They are deserving of equal praise.
But what for me is the most notable part of his letters is that while he was writing, while the campaign was actually underway, but at the same time he showed his understanding that this was an important campaign for Australia and for Australian histories. What he wrote about the landing, I'll just quote, and I think it's important, he wrote, "The landing was never to be forgotten ever in the history of the world. Australia may well be proud and boast of her loyal sons." But the irony of that was, and it didn't occur to him, and that for so many years, this didn't apply to Australia's Aboriginal sons.
Thomas Williams, age 41 years 3 months, height 5 feet 8 inches, weight 111 pounds, complexion dark, eyes brown, hair black, religion Church of England.
Thomas Williams is an example of the lack of consistency in the actions of the recruiters, because he was one of the number of men who were able to serve overseas, but only after enlisting a second time. He was a Gamilaroi man, and he enlisted, first of all, in 1916, in January 1916. He joined the 33rd Battalion, but inexplicably, 3 months later, he was discharged. It was an honourable discharge. But there's no mention in his service record that he was discharged because of race, but I think it's quite likely. Well, he then waited 3 months, and then he did what a lot of other Aboriginal men did, and he's typical of them. He applied again, but what he did was he changed his details. He changed his age, he changed his place of birth, and he changed his place of enlistment. It was Narrabri this time. And he also changed his name, but he didn't change his next of kin. So he served until 1919 in Egypt. He served with the 6th Light Horse, and he also served with the Army Service Corps. But when he came home in 1919, he decided he did not want to be under the strictures of the Aborigines Protection Board, and he wanted freedom from that. And that was possibly because of the sort of freedom he experienced in the Army. So he settled in an Aboriginal community at Saltpan on the Georges River near Sydney, which seemed to be pretty free from the domination of the board. And he changed his name back to Tom Williams, and he got married. But What I think his service is important because, as I said, it shows the lack of consistency in approach of the recruiters and that they couldn't ignore the divisions of the Defence Act. And I think the fact that these recruiters were so inconsistent is probably one reason by the fact that Aboriginal men kept on reapplying because they realised that this was so.
Jerome Locke, age 44 years, 5 months. Height, 5 feet, 6.5 inches. Weight, 132 pounds. Complexion, dark. Eyes, brown. Hair, dark. Religion, Church of England.
Jerome Locke was a Darug man and he was from the Sydney area. And he was the grandson of Maria Locke. And she's famous, amongst other things, because she had a white convict assigned to her as a servant, and she actually married him. And his great-grandfather was Yarramundi, who was the leader of the Burraburrungal clan of the Darug. So through this heritage, he's linked to invasion times and pre-invasion times. Prior to World War One, he was a member of a colonial force. He was a member of the Windsor Rifles. He had no trouble enlisting in Windsor Rifles. And there's a great picture of him in his uniform for this unit, and he was also a crack shot and a prize winner in competitions. In 1916, he and two of his sons enlisted. They'd previously been in an enlistment, one of those enlistment recruiting matches, the Rifle Reserve 1000. They enlisted successfully. He served with the 36th and the 53rd Battalion in France. But he didn't serve for very long because before the end of 1916, he was hospitalised with trench foot and then he was sent home and discharged. I don't think he was sent home and discharged because of reasons of race. I think that the reason I think it's pretty clear, was that he was not a young man. Although he said he was 41, actually he was probably at least 10 years older, and the trenches would not have been a very hospitable place for an older man. But Jerome wasn't deterred. In 1919, he volunteered for the AIF again. But in 1919, the war was still officially not over. The Treaty of Versailles hadn't been signed. So he volunteered in 1919 and he was attached to a unit which had escort duties, escorting German deportees. But what I think distinguishes his career, and what's notable about his career is, well, one thing is his age, because when he volunteered in 1919, this time his details remain roughly the same apart from his age. And his age, he said this time, was 51, but it's quite likely it was a few years older than that. So this makes him one of the old, possibly the oldest Aboriginal man to serve in World War One. And his service is distinguished too because of its span. From 1889 to 1919, which encompassed a period of about 30 years. But the third thing to say about his service is the fact that he was possibly the first Aboriginal man to serve on land in a colonial military force.
Frederick Prentice, age 21 years, 4 months, height 5 feet, 11.5 inches, weight 167 pounds. Complexion, dark. Eyes, brown. Hair, black. Religion, Protestant.
Frederick Prentice was a member of what today is known as the Stolen Generations, and he's also one of those Aboriginal men who actually was awarded a medal, got a bravery award. And his story is quite a tragic one. He was born in Powell Creek in the Northern Territory. His mother was a Chinglin woman and his father was white. He was fostered by the telegraphist at the Powell Creek Overland Telegraph Station and his wife. They were elderly people. Some years later, they moved to South Australia, where Frederick was sent to a private school, to Carr College, which became Scotch College. And he excelled in music and also in sport, in cricket and in football. And in 1915, he volunteered and he served in France. And in July, he was in Pozières in the vicinity of Beausire in July 1916 near Mouquet Farm, and this was where his actions earned him his gallantry award, and he was awarded the military medal. And this was for bringing guns and ammunition up to the front under heavy enemy fire. He returned home in 1919, and when he returned home, he received a hero's welcome. He was associated with and was described as a fine type of man and a man of manly bearing, and he was applauded by them. But from then on, really, things started to go wrong for Frederick. His parents were elderly, his foster parents, and they died. He lost connection with his foster family. The next 30 years or so, he spent mainly in mining towns in Western Australia and in the Northern Territory. And he seems to have been increasingly solitary. He didn't marry. We don't know anything about his friends. And by 1957, he died. In 1957, he died. He was found in his camp. He'd rolled into the fire and he was badly burnt and possibly died from some other causes. No one really knew much about him. His name was known and he had mentioned someone had been in the war, and he was buried in an unmarked grave. So really, his story was lost. But things, although he was dead, things took a turn for the better in 1991, because Christine Kramer and Eric Catterall, who were related to the Kells, decided to investigate the family story of this young Aboriginal man who'd been fostered, young child. Since then, efforts are being made to find his grave and to note his war service on his grave. But it is a tragic story, and I think a lot of his tragedy is associated with the fact that he was removed from his family. But his recognition in later life, in death, also extended to the fact that we've been able to find a portrait of him. I identified it from an unknown portrait at the War Memorial, and it echoes the description I've mentioned before of his manly bearing. And in 2015, this portrait was projected on one of the pylons of the Harbour Bridge. So he did achieve recognition, but this was after he died. Basically, as I said, his life was tragic, and perhaps a really tragic, sad footnote to his life is that a few years ago, his military medal was found on a rubbish heap outside Katherine.
Robert George Garner, age 24 years, 9 months, height 5 feet 6 inches, weight 135 pounds, complexion very dark, eyes brown, hair black, religion Church of England.
Robert George Garner is an Aboriginal man who served in the First World War. His Aboriginality comes from the Port Stephens area. It's Warramai. He's distinguished by the fact that in addition to his Aboriginality, he had African American heritage. He was 24 when he volunteered in November 1915, and he served with the 17th Battalion in France.
Robert's story is a personal one for me. He served alongside his brother Elias McAllister, my great-grandfather.
Well, Robert is fairly rare because he's one of 21 Aboriginal men that were POWs in the First World War, and his connection to his brother is very coincidental, as Robert was captured at the First Battle of Bullancourt in April of 1917, and his brother Elias was wounded in the Second Battle of Bullancourt in May that year. So they're in the same area, they're fighting the same fight, but the two different divergent results for the men result in Robert being captured and going on to serve in and throughout the labour camps and also back to Germany, and his brother being wounded and brought home in 1918. His service would have been those larger battles in the later 1916. He enlists in 1916, gets over and serves through his training camp, and is allocated to the 17th Battalion, and they get onto the Western Front in late 1916. And from there, he's back and forward. He's had some rest, he has some medical issues, and he starts getting his wounds. He gets gassed. We find that he'd suffered gas poisoning and the effects of being gassed, which was a tactic being used by the Germans in the First World War, and a lot of the men that were on the front lines would have suffered that same affliction at the time. And you find that it all depends on how quickly they could get their respiratory equipment on or off, and that would you will find that those incidents happen across his battalion and his companies.
I've often wondered what life would have been like in these prison camps.
Life for captured prisoner of war's soldiers is very hard at the first, because Robert's a non-commissioned officer, he's a private, and he's subject to the labour, and he's working to provide the labour for the Germans on the way back through the lines. On the front lines, he's in the high-risk areas. He's probably taking ammunition to the front lines, taking rations to the troops. But then as he moves back, because he's wounded, he gets treated medically, and his leg is not in a good condition from his wound. He gets treated back through the medical evacuation route on the Western Front through the Germans, and he gets put into internment camps in Germany in the end.
His time in the prisoner of war camp was not a pleasant time, but there was one positive from his POW experience, and that was that he was actually able to be, he was photographed. There was a French prisoner of war who photographed other prisoners of war. He put this in an album, and this album surfaced in the 21st century and was bought by a collector who actually put the images online. And I think this is one of the more beautiful photos of an Aboriginal serviceman, because despite the terribly adverse conditions he was in, he stands there very proudly, and he's showing pride in his membership of the AIF.
My name is Ian Roftoft. I'm from Belgium. I found Mr. Garner's photograph on an auction website. The album belonged to a French soldier, Mr. Emile Landsberg, and there are also a lot of portraits of him in the book. Normally you find one or two or three pictures, not a complete album. So it got my attention, and the sellers showed me only a few pictures. And all of these pictures were from French prisoners of war. So when I finally got the album, I was surprised there were also pictures from English soldier in it, and also one picture from an Aboriginal digger. And it was not glued in the album, so I could take it out. And when I turned it to the backside, I saw there was a name on it, Mr. Garner, and also the name of his village. The man in the picture, Mr. Garner, he looked also very proud in the picture. He looked healthy, well-fed, and not like most pictures of prisoners of war.
It's one of only three known photos of Aboriginal POWs in the First World War. He's showing that he did serve, and he's in a lesser-known aspect of the service. He's a POW. He's got his wound stripes on there. But it's the image of an Aboriginal man in a POW camp, which was a lesser-known story of the even lesser-known story of Aboriginal service. The purpose of these photos, Jay, is to tell their story, send them back home. These photos would have been turned into a postcard, and on the back it would have just sent a name and address as a normal postcard, and it's just to tell your mum and dad that you're healthy. He's looking clean. He's you know, although he's not smiling in there, you can tell he's healthy. And it's a propaganda photo. Being allowed to have been taken in a prisoner of war camp is the Germans telling the Australian people that they're treating their prisoners well. And in return, they're looking to that exchange. So we look after your prisoners, you look after our prisoners. So they've treated him well. It's about a propaganda, and it's messages that it's sending out to the Australian people through the community, that we are treating your prisoners well, but also that they're treating people of colour and accepting people of colour extremely well.
I've come to see Robert's daughter, Faye. She turns 89 this year, but she's still going strong. I want to see how she remembers her dad and ask if she knew much about his time in the war.
Hey.
Hello, Jay. Come in.
How are you going?
Oh, I'm going good. Thanks.
Good
How are you going?
Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you too.
What are some of the memories of your dad? Obviously, he died when you were 5 or 6, but do you have any memories of him growing up or memories that your mum told you about him?
Yes, I do have memories of my father playing the guitar, and he used to sing too, but he used to busk in the streets of Newcastle, and he did try to teach me how to tap dance. Well, my mother did talk about my father's war service, but did not say much about it. You know, they didn't talk about it much at all. And the same with Uncle Elias. He never spoke about it either, you know. So my father was injured in the war. He was shot in the leg and gassed, which would have caused his illness, problem with his lungs. It might have turned to cancer, I believe.
Yeah. Now, a key element to this story is the photo that emerged of your dad. Can you tell us your thoughts on that photo and what that means to you?
Oh, it meant such a lot. Yes, I was really amazed about that photo of my dad, really amazed that it happened that way. It was just a chance in a million, you know, that would turn up.
I knew the photo was an important piece of our family history, so I wanted to get it back.
It was, I think, one of the most unique pictures in my collection, but it's more important that it's now where it belongs, in Australia, with his daughter.
Well, I've managed to track down the original photo of your dad. I've got it here, and I wanted to let you have it.
Oh, my goodness.
That's the original.
That's the original.
Original copy.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yes, thank you very much. I'm sure that, he was holding onto that chair for support, I would say.
Yeah.
In that photo, yes. Oh, my goodness, I'll have to think about what I'll do with this photo. Yes, I'll have to give it some thought, but I'll cherish it.
Like many of his peers, Robert was buried in an unmarked grave. But after his story became more well-known, the Department of War Graves awarded him a new commemorative plot and headstone.
Oh, there it is. There's the grave. Oh, doesn't it? It's really nice now, isn't it?
Yeah, no.
They've done a wonderful job.
You happy with it?
Yes, I'm happy with it, yes. And many thanks to the Department of War Graves for doing this, because my father certainly, he deserved it.
How about these some flowers for him then, eh?
Yes, okay. Yes, maybe rest in peace.
Sometimes when this place gets kinda empty, sound of the breath fades with the light.
Dear sir, I'm writing to ask if you would kindly forward me a duplicate of my military discharge, which I've unfortunately lost. My particulars are as follows. Private R.G. Garner, 5015, returned badge number 98779. Yours sincerely, Robert George Garner.
Lower the curtain down on the right. I've got no time for private consultation under the Milky Way tonight. Wish I knew what you might have known what you would find.
That's Jimmy Little with Under the Milky Way. That's the show for now. Join us again next time for more inspiring stories from across Indigenous Australia. This program was produced by myself, Jay McAllister. The sound design for this program was by Tim Jenkins. You can email the program speakingout@abc.net.au or find us on social media via ABC Indigenous. I'm Jay McAllister and this is Speaking Out.